we die, we want people to accept it. We are in a risky business, and we hope that if anything happens to us, it will not delay the program. The conquest of space is worth the risk of life. You are listening to Western Worlds. Hello, and welcome back for another conversation here on Western Worlds, an AFM original show heard right here on astronomy.fm. My name is Dr. John, and I'm coming to you this week, as every week, from the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration at Western University, home of the Meteor Physics Group in London, Ontario, Canada. Space exploration has never been an entirely safe endeavor. To understand those risks, you need look no further than our opening quote. One of the reasons that text resonates is because its author, Gus Grissom, would later be killed in the fire that consumed the command module of Apollo 1. But by acknowledging that space exploration comes with risk does not mean that we should abandon the effort. However, it does mean that it is worth trying to mitigate those risks wherever possible. In the aftermath of another tragedy, the disintegration of the space shuttle Columbia upon atmospheric reentry in 2003, NASA decided to restart their efforts to quantify the amount and timing of small particles near the Earth. Such information not only helps the operators of satellites, but also informs the scheduling of EVAs by astronauts so as to limit their exposure to the tiny particles that could puncture and decompress their suits. It is a daunting task. These particles travel at speeds in excess of 7 kilometers per second and are so small as to be all but invisible until they strike a spacecraft or burn up in our atmosphere as meteors. Leading the effort to understand these particles is Bill Cook of the NASA Meteoroid Environments Office, and he is our guest here tonight on Western Worlds. As James Cameron has noted, the historical success of nations rests on balancing risks and rewards. In the last few years, Dr. Cook has helped to push that balance a little bit more in our favor. Transitioning us to Alyssa Gilbert's interview is Antarctic Echoes by Vangelis.
So thank you, Bill, for joining us today on Western Worlds.
You're welcome.
So you are the lead of the Meteoroid Environment Office at NASA. Could you maybe tell us a bit about what that office does and what your role is within that office?
Well, the NASA Meteoroid Environments Office is a safety organization, not a science organization. Our primary job is to come up with models of the meteoroid environment to help design spacecraft and also to generate meteor shower forecasts for spacecraft already up there. So if there's a meteor storm or meteor outburst, they can take steps to protect their spacecraft. So in a nutshell, that's what we do. We also fund research with our limited dollars to help improve the design model and the meteor shower forecast. What I do is I basically do all the bureaucratic stuff, like handle the budgets. And I also do a bit of meteor shower forecasting. That's my strength. So I do have some technical skills, but they're vanishing fast.
You have some partnerships here within the Center of Planetary Science and Exploration with Dr. Peter Brown and Margaret Crandall Brown and Paul Wiegert. Could you tell us a bit about what that collaboration is about and what they do for you?
Well, this story kind of begins back in 1970. In 1970, we had gone to the moon. You know, we had the first few Apollos. And NASA decided at that time that they knew enough about the meteoroid environment. In 1969, the meteoroid group at JSC published a document on the near-Earth and interplanetary meteoroid environment, whereupon NASA management said, fine, you've done your job, thank you, we're going to shut you down. So in academics, you have publish or perish. In their case, it was publish and perish. And for many years, 34 to be precise, NASA had no meteoroid office. And the few people in NASA that were doing meteoroids either passed on or retired out. So NASA lost that capability. And along came the Columbia disaster in 2003. And even though meteoroids were not responsible, one of the outcomes of all the studies that were done analyzing that accident revealed that NASA had lost its meteoroid expertise. So in 2004, my office was created. And since we had worked with Western on the Leonid meteor storms, I've been working with Dr. Brown since 1998, since he was a graduate student. We turned to Western to help us rebuild NASA's lost meteoroid capability because up here at Western you had preserved a large amount of meteoroid knowledge, so it was logical to come to you, especially since there were no other institutions in the United States that had a comparable knowledge base. Okay. You guys were the best, you were the experts in North America, so we came to you and we just continued our collaboration from Leonids on into other area. So, you know, we turn to Western. Of course, you operate the Seymour Meteor Radar for us. Dr. Wiegert helps us with our dynamical questions and meteor shower forecasting. Margaret helps us with fluxes and instruments, optical instrumentation. We turn to you guys for help in those areas. And oftentimes, we end up duplicating in the States what you have here. For example, I'm constructing a meteor network based on the Southern Ontario Meteor Network. It uses the same software, ASGARD, that was developed here. And I'm also about to duplicate what we call the Romulan cameras that are at Elgin Field in Tavistock and move them in the desert southwest where the weather is a bit better and we'll see more meteors. But a lot of stuff that's developed under the agreement we have with you guys, we can take it and apply it directly to NASA problems, like to generate real-time fluxes. Space situational awareness is a big deal. We want to know what's going on around us so we can respond quickly to it.
Right, because what kind of damage can these, I mean, we think of these little tiny meteoroids floating around, you know, people think of them as these tiny rocks, but they don't know is that they're going tens of kilometers per second and they can do some large damage. So,
well, right now our concern is, you know, with designing the commercial crew vehicles, the vehicles that visit ISS. This is on the manned side, of course. And a continued worry is space station. You know, even though space station's up there and space station is armored like a tank, it has armor, meteoroids are not generally a problem for it. Space station armor will stop a 2-centimeter particle from penetrating.
Okay.
But astronauts on EVA doing spacewalks are vulnerable. They're out there for 7-8 hours of time, and it only takes a 0.3 millimeter particle to penetrate a spacesuit. You talk to an astronaut, what is your big worry when you're on EVA? He goes, I'm worried about getting popped by a meteoroid or a piece of space debris. And it turns out at those sizes, the meteoroid contribution is as big as the space debris contribution. So one of our jobs is to generate forecasts for activity when astronauts go out EVA, and that's one of our big concerns. Astronauts on spacewalks on EVAs are vulnerable to that environment.
You talked about new designs for spacecraft as well, and how this type of forecasting is going to be kind of influencing that type of design.
Well, the sporadic model, there's a design model, and what it tells you, the old NASA meteoroid models didn't incorporate the directionality of the environment. They just smeared it all out. It was isotropic. Well, with these new models, you know where to put your shielding. Say if you have a very vulnerable payload and you want to shield it, you know where to place the shields thanks to the data we've got in these new models. As far as the forecast, they help operations. You know when the peak of a meteor outburst is going to occur. You know the direction the meteors are coming from. You can do things like turn the spacecraft so that your hard side faces towards the radiant, the nuclear attack position.
Right.
Or you can shut down high voltage systems and stuff like that. So all this stuff factors into it.
Okay, so you mentioned that Western at the time was kind of the place in North America for this type of research.
It still is.
It still is, yeah. There aren't a lot of collaborations, though, between NASA and sites in Canada.
I think we have the only NASA cooperative agreement with Canada.
Is that just a political thing, mostly?
Cooperative agreements are very hard to negotiate. They take years to do. Even renewing them takes months. So they're very hard things to do, and there are very stringent rules applied. It is only because I think that Western has all this expertise that is lacking in the United States that I was able to negotiate a cooperative agreement with Western. Because the first question you get is, well, is this experience available in the U.S.? And
right.
I can legitimately say no in the case of the stuff we do.
Which is interesting. You mentioned how they kind of disbanded the meteoroid research, and it was 34 years ago.
1970.
So it's interesting because I don't know if you know what's going on in Canada with all the science cuts and stuff. I wonder if that's going to be, I mean, it doesn't happen in the meteoroid stuff in particular, but for example, the CSA budgets have been slashed and there's been a bunch of scientific places that have been shut down completely. And I think that's going to be a problem 20 years from now when all of a sudden they want all this funding back and there's not going to be no one around to do it. Is that what kind of happened?
Yeah, that's what happened when we lost the meteoroid program at JSC. Those guys either moved on or there were a couple left on Kessler and Herb Zook, who kind of did it on the side for a few years.
Okay.
But Herb Zook passed away and Don Kessler retired, so it goes away. If you have no people for 34 years, think about it. I mean, even if you're a 20-year-old person, when that 34-year period starts, by the time it's over, you're 54, you're looking at retiring, right? So there were no people coming into the area to fill the gap, so it just went away.
Yeah. So are there more people coming into the field now in the U.S.?
We're trying. We're trying to get more people interested. I'm taking on interns now.
Okay.
You know, so I have an intern every semester.
Okay.
You know, there's a fall, spring, and summer semester down in Alabama where I'm from. So I'm taking on interns now to try to motivate U.S. students to get involved.
And these are undergraduate students?
Undergraduate or graduate. You know, I'm trying to get them motivated to do meteor work. And we do things with people up here, you know, like Rhiannon Blau used to work up here at Western in the meteor physics group, and she's a U.S. citizen, has dual citizenship, so I was able to hire her, and she now works in my group.
Okay.
So she left Western and got a job with NASA. Sometimes it works out famously, and I've been very happy with Rhiannon. You know, if you were all U.S. citizen, I'd take you all if I had the money.
So we talked about the dangers of these types of things, but you also do a lot of meteor streams analysis, and you talked about the Leonid meteor shower in particular. Can you tell us a little bit about that research that you're interested in?
Well, yeah, the Leonid storms are pretty much over, unfortunately.
Yes.
They were very big events. There are certain meteor showers that give us issue. The Perseids in August. Whenever they outburst, we seem to have a spacecraft go crazy. It happened in 1993 with the Olympus spacecraft. It happened in 2009 with the Landsat 5 spacecraft. And in 2016, there's another outburst predicted. So one of the things I was discussing in my visit up here this time was we need to look at 2016, figure out how strong that outburst is, and decide what sort of warning I need to issue to spacecraft operators. So, we're very focused on certain meteor showers, the Perseids in particular, because of all the meteor showers, they're the one that causes the most trouble.
Okay, just because there's just a lot more particles in that shower?
We don't understand it.
They
seem to cause a lot of electrical disruptions in satellites.
Hmm.
The idea, you know, most people think when a meteoroid hits a satellite, it's going to go right through, you know, and destroy it. You know, the Armageddon movie, right?
Right?
But actually, a small meteoroid can hit a satellite satellite, and even though it doesn't cause anything more than leaving a slight crater on the surface of the satellite, it can generate a plasma cloud that will allow current, and spacecraft are charged, and it can allow current to flow into electronics that control the spacecraft attitude or other things and send them tumbling out of control. And the Perseids seem to generate a lot of electrical anomalies. The Perseids are something that we have concern about because of all meteor showers, they've caused the most anomalies.
And you're just not sure why?
Nope, but hey, I've got 4 years to figure it out.
Okay, maybe you can tell our listeners who aren't really familiar with meteor streams all that much where meteor streams come from.
Well, most meteor showers, meteor streams come from comets, right? The Perseids come from Comet Swift-Tuttle. The Leonids come from Comet Temple-Tuttle. The Orionids, Halley's Comet. There are a couple of exceptions. The Geminids come from an asteroid, 3200 Phaethon. So these are particles that have been ejected from the comet or maybe from an asteroid breakup. We know 32 Phaethon has a smaller chunk of it flowing around the inner solar system. So these particles may intersect the orbit of the Earth at some point, and when the Earth runs into that stream of material, you get a meteor shower. They're the most famous meteor showers, of course, are the Perseids in August, the one everybody likes to watch. The most intense meteor shower in the year is the Geminids in December, but no one watches that much because cold December nights, right?
Right.
You know, but it's also, especially up here.
Yeah. But it's more chance to be clear, depending on where you are.
It does have more chance to be clear, but I can remember when I was very young in junior high school, you know, seventh grade on the roof of a planetarium freezing trying to watch Geminids. And I can tell you I didn't see many meteors because I was more concerned about staying warm. And this was down in North Georgia, so I cannot imagine what a meteor watcher up here would go through on a December night.
So these meteor showers are obviously different from the random meteors that we see.
Yeah, those are sporadics. And the sporadic background is what we designed to. Even though the meteor showers are more visually spectacular, 90% of spacecraft risk comes from the sporadic background, the stuff that's already there. And the reason why is it's always there,
yeah.
Right? Meteor showers last a few days, they're gone at most. But the sporadic background accounts for 90% of risk to spacecraft.
Okay, that's just because it's always going on.
It's always going
and
on.
And it's coming
always
from
there. Everywhere.
Is it random direction or is it?
Well, no, there's stuff coming out of the direction of the Earth's motion. There's stuff coming out of the sun and opposite the sun. Very little stuff hitting you in the rear, though.
Yeah.
So there is directionality to it. And it has a lot of small particles. And as I said, it only takes a 0.3 millimeter particle to go to the spacesuit. A 0.1 millimeter particle can cut a wire that's on the outside of the spacecraft. Small particles are very often your risk drivers because there's so few big particles, right? I don't worry about a 5-centimeter particle going through space station armor nearly as much as I worry about that 0.3 millimeter particle hitting an astronaut.
Just because there's so many more of them.
So many more of them.
So what do you find is the biggest misconception when you talk about meteors and...
Most people think we know everything, and that's the biggest conception. I had a NASA program several years back. It was a study, actually, and I got an email and asking me to come to a meeting. I went to the meeting, and they were talking about a probe to the Alpha Centauri system, and they thought that I knew what the meteoroid environment was in the Alpha Centauri system. And I explained to them I didn't know what the meteoroid environment was in our own solar system, much less in the Alpha Centauri system. Right. A lot of people think we've been there, done that. We know everything, and the truth is actually far from that concept. And that has been my biggest issue, not only in dealing with the public who think NASA tracks everything, which we don't do. As a matter of fact, the Department of Defense tracks all the man-made stuff.
Okay.
My camera network only sees meteors over the southeast when they enter the atmosphere. We can't see meteors out in space. That has been my trouble with the general public and also with NASA managers who think that, hey, we've done this many years ago, we know everything, and they don't realize the truth is actually far from that.
Right, and that's actually a general problem
exactly.
In all of sciences, is we did that 30 years ago, so we don't need to do it again.
Exactly.
It can be tough to overcome, I'm sure, especially in this time of budget cuts and people cuts and stuff like that.
Actually, it's hard times in the States, too,
yeah.
For a lot of people, but we call media Meteoroids and Orbital Debris, MMOD, at NASA for micrometeoroids and orbital debris. I don't like the micrometeoroids part, but Mission Operations Directorate is MOD, and you can't have two acronyms that conflict. So we're MMOD. There's a lot of interest as such. It hasn't been cut as badly as others. And even here in Canada, CSA just got a membership in the Interagency Debris Council, the IADC. They just had a meeting up in Montreal at McGill, I believe is the place. Canada is taking an active role, at least on the space debris side, the man-made. So your country has just joined the IADC, and that at least certainly indicates that they have interest in at least the man-made space debris area.
I don't know if we want to kind of maybe end with maybe how you got to where you are now. What was your educational and work history, and how did you get to be the leader of this office?
Education, you know, I grew up south of Chattanooga, Tennessee, in North Georgia. I went to undergraduate school at a small college in the south of the state, Valdosta State College. It's now Valdosta State University. Got a degree in physics and astronomy. Went to graduate school at the University of Florida. Got a PhD in astronomy, and right after I got out, I came to work as a contractor for NASA, working space station collision avoidance, and I gradually moved in areas. But while I was a graduate student, I worked on several spacecraft projects involving interplanetary dust. I worked on an experiment called OPE, which flew on the European mission to Halley's Comet, Giotto, and I worked on an experiment that flew on the third shuttle mission, and I worked on the interplanetary dust experiment that flew on the LDAF spacecraft. I got a lot of space experience as a grad student, which helped me convince me I did not want to be a faculty member. I wanted to go and do more space stuff. So I came to work for NASA, and I started doing meteor work in 1998 for the Leonids and met Dr. Brown. I just became informally recognized as a meteor shower expert within NASA, and that led when the office was created in 2004, me assuming the lead role. Kind of just fell into it. I like the space connection. It was very fun. Besides, I don't think I could teach a class if I had to.
Well, great. Thank you so much for interviewing with us on Western Worlds, and hopefully we can talk again in the future.
You are listening to Western Worlds on astronomy.fm. Let's go to the discussion.
So we just listened to my interview with Bill Cook, who is the lead of NASA's Meteoroid Environment Office, and he talked a lot about the meteoroid environment around Earth and how their office, with the help from the meteor physics group here at Western, monitors that environment, especially for astronauts who are doing their spacewalks, as well as other space equipment and satellites and telescopes and such that are out in orbit, which is a very interesting thing because, you know, we have these little tiny particles that are floating around and people don't think that they can do much damage, but of course they're traveling at hypervelocity up to 70 kilometers a second, some of them, and can do some serious damage. So it's very important that we can protect our astronauts and equipment from these kind of impacts.
Yeah, the kinetic energy goes with the square of the velocity, so you don't need a whole lot of mass before you make a big mess.
Yeah, even things as small as a paint chip. I mean, we're talking about stuff that's below the level of what the Air Force can track. And it can be a real problem, especially as we go on and more of the debris in orbit sort of fragments, I believe is the kind term, into smaller and smaller pieces.
That's right. We talk about the space junk or space debris that's out in orbit. There's a lot of satellites, for example, that have gone offline, or there are various things flying around, like I think there's a glove out there and some garbage bags and stuff like that. And if they hit each other and collide, they can break apart. And then you have more and more space junk. And it can become a problem where all of a sudden it could actually take out entire satellite systems if it gets really... Yeah.
Well, and a major problem on the debris side is things like discarded rocket bodies, upper stages that are no longer used, may have been there for 20 years and still have some fuel in the tank. And one of these days that's going to rupture. And that makes a whole lot of mess. little pieces scattered about in orbit.
So I know there is the IEDC, which we mentioned, that was mentioned in the interview, that the CSA is now a part of. And their mandate is to really, well, first figure out ways of how to monitor this space debris, but also come up with ways on how to maybe clean it up or get it back to Earth. And I don't know if there are any ideas out there that you guys have heard of how to do this.
Well, there's a number of groups who've come up with various ways of getting rid of it. The problem is you've got to launch a lot of stuff into orbit to make it happen. I know that Madonna Detweiler has been working on some of these things, and there are groups south of the border as well. Nothing quite seems ready for prime time yet.
Well, it's really hard. Like, it's a difficult thing to do. If you want to catch the small pieces, first you have to find them. Then you have to spend a lot of fuel and hardware getting up to them. And then you catch them, I guess. And then what, hang on to them until your debris cleaner re-enters or something? There's all kinds of plans about trying to catch them in a net or ablate them with lasers or...
Or big magnets.
Yeah, I think the most promising suggestion that I've heard is give up on the small things and go get the big ones. The big rocket bodies, for example.
Yeah, prevent that fragmentation.
Exactly. Go take 5 or 10 of the biggest things that are up there out, and you'll solve... You'll put off the Kessler syndrome for a while.
It's true, because the small... this is a problem, with the exception of GEO. That's geostationary orbit. In low Earth orbit, this is a problem that will solve itself, given enough time.
That's right, yeah. There's still atmospheric drag. But, of course, with the meteoroid problem, that's not going to solve itself.
That's right.
That keeps coming. The solar system is full of that dust.
And not just the solar system. Some of these particles come from other solar systems as well. I mean, we've got a great group here at Western Ontario, real world leaders in the field, that look with all-sky cameras and can figure out the speed at which this stuff comes in. And over a certain threshold, you know it's not from our own solar system.
That's right. They do look at interstellar meteors as well as the sporadic meteors and the meteors from showers that we talked about in the interview. Not only do they have the all-sky cameras, but that we also have a radar, and I think it's 2-station radar now, and they have an infrasound detection, so the large objects coming through the atmosphere that create those fireballs, we can actually detect. Funny enough, they can detect things also like space shuttle launches and explosions that happened nearby. There was actually an incident a few years ago where there was a meth lab explosion north of London, and it picked up the infrasound of that. So they have, they have this suite of instruments, which is very rare. Usually places who study this stuff, it's either one or the other. But having this suite of instruments allows them to really get specific or accurate orbits and velocities and sizes and compositions, which has really helped this area of research on meteors.
Nonetheless, as Dr. Cook points out, there's a great deal that we don't know. He's perhaps the leader on this in the field. You know, he still has a great deal that he can't report to NASA. You know,
that's right.
Not just what's going on in Alpha Centauri, but what's going on in this solar system.
Which can be a worry for future missions, right? If we want to send astronauts or satellites or something to other planets, I mean, we have no idea what the meteoroid population or density is like at these other places.
Yeah,
it's true, but it becomes a question of risk management. I can't say that I remember because I wasn't alive at the time, but before the Pioneer spacecraft went out to visit Jupiter and Saturn, there was the real question of whether or not the asteroid belt was a region of the solar system that was crossable safely.
Right.
And was there, again, fragmentation into so many small pieces that there would not be a way through that was survivable? After the Pioneers, we discovered that it actually is an environment that we can get through with a lot of confidence, and now we regularly pass through the asteroid belt when we go on these missions of exploration.
Mm-hmm. So. That's actually one of the biggest misconceptions that I run into is, thanks to Star Wars and Star Trek and all those wonderful shows that we love so dearly, everyone thinks it's these, you know, fields of giant rocks that you weave in and out of, when in reality there's an average of 400,000 kilometers between asteroids, you know?
Of course they do run into each other every so often, which is how we get meteorites.
That's right. That's how some of them do arrive in the inner solar system. Of course, a lot of them come from comets as well, leaving their dust trails behind, and that's why we get these beautiful Leonid showers and the Perseids. I think it's the Geminids that he mentioned is actually from an asteroid, but we actually think that it may have been a comet in the past. It has just lost all of its ices or something like that.
I had appreciated, I think, the kinetic danger to spacecraft from these small particles. But Dr. Cook points out also that there's this charged plasma danger when they collide, and it creates this field of ionized material.
That's right. That's not something I never thought about either.
Charge particles surrounding spacecraft are a real hassle. With arcing on solar panels and things, you can mess up your electronics pretty badly.
There are ways of that have been proposed in the past for using that as well, I know, of having sort of tethers and using differences in charge and magnetic field to do some navigation within the Earth's orbit.
Right, yeah, for deorbiting, for example, long tethers. There was an experiment a few years ago which was claimed as a success of deorbiting a little capsule off of another spacecraft. They call it a success because they did reel out the tether and the capsule did separate. They never found it again. But nonetheless, they managed to unwind the cable, so that was something. What's interesting is that, you know, Dr. Cook points out that this is, you know, his office is a service to NASA of safety, not of science. That this is something that you need to know if you're going to work in this environment, and we still don't know it. Scientifically, it's an interesting question, but this is more on the side of astronautics, of how do we operate in space? Well, we need to know what space is like. And I guess after 30-plus years of neglecting the question, we still don't know.
That's our show for this week. Western Worlds is a co-production of the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration and Astronomy.fm. This episode was produced by Alyssa Gilbert and Michael Forster and featured an interview by co-host Alyssa Gilbert. Our roundtable discussion featured co-hosts Raymond Francis, John Moores, and Alyssa Gilbert. Our editors were Alyssa Gilbert, John Moores, and Michael Forster. And as always, I'm Dr. John. You can continue the conversation online or learn more about Western Worlds by visiting our website, cpsx.uwo.ca/westernworlds. You can also email us at westernworlds@uwo.ca. On Twitter, we are at WWAFM, and on Facebook, we are Western-Worlds. On behalf of everyone here at Western Worlds, I'd like to thank you for joining us tonight. I hope that you can make world enough and time for Western Worlds again next week, right here on astronomy.fm.